On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chee on the show today. Mr. Curtis Franklin's gallivanting in the Sin City, so we'll have to get an update from him about Black Hat and DEF CON at a later date. But you ever wonder how well federal agencies would do if they were audited for cybersecurity? Well, Brian and I will talk about a new report that just might surprise you. Plus, Chiebert will also take us through Viasat and how it's worried about Starlink competition. And also, we have a great guest, Joe Byrne. He's regional CTO of Cisco AppDynamics, to talk about application performance management and just how the new norm has caused organizations in every sector to make some changes for their applications to stay afloat. Shouldn't miss it. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 455, recorded August 6th, 2021. What's in your app? This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. With an innovative culture, thousands of IT engineers, application developers, unmatched labs, and integration centers for testing and deploying technology at scale, WWT helps customers bridge the gap between strategy and execution. To learn more about WWT, visit WWT.com/TWIT. And by Bitwarden. Get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that can drastically increase your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at Bitwarden.com/TWIT. And by IT Pro TV. With 7 studios and over 5,800 hours of IT training, IT Pro TV creates the perfect environment for you to learn IT, and they're always adding new content. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use code ENTERPRISE30 at checkout. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Boresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, and he's our network and security expert and all-around tech geek, Mr. Brian Chee. Chiebert, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing fine. I'm just looking forward to being able to do projects with my partner in crime, KG4GWA, Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's currently at Black Hat DEF CON in Lost Wages. And when he gets back, I think we're going to go and start doing some electrical work at both his house and my house. Ought to be fun.
Thanks, Chiebert. That's right. Well, while Curtis gallivants in the Sin City has some fun, we do have a lot to talk about still. That's right. The Enterprise Week has been very busy. Now, you ever wonder how well some of the federal agencies out there would do if they were audited for cybersecurity? Well, Chiebert and I will get into that, talk about just about a new report that came out. You just might be surprised how these organizations were graded. Now, organizations are consistently striving for new services to be fast, reliable, consistent. Well, today we have Joe Byrne, regional CTO of Cisco AppDynamics, and he'll talk about the new norm and just how you can make your digital and app services more reliable, more performant for the new norm. Shouldn't miss it. But first, like we always do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, phishing campaigns target your users, not your defenses or your perimeters. It only takes one user to cause a ton of trouble for your network and services. Well, according to this latest phishing report, it could be targeting your Office 365 users as well. Now, Microsoft's security intelligence team has issued an alert to Office 365 users and admins to be on the lookout for a crafty phishing email with spoofed sender addresses. Now, Microsoft put out an alert after observing an active campaign targeting Office 365 organizations with a convincing email and several techniques to bypass phishing detection, including an Office 365 phishing page, Google Cloud web app hosting, and a compromised SharePoint site that urges victims to type in their credentials. Now, the original sender addresses contain variations of the word referral and use various top-level domains, including the domain com.com, popularly used for phishing campaigns for phishing and type O squatting. Now, this begs repeating. Phishing is a key component of business email compromise attacks, which cost Americans more than $4.2 billion last year, according to the FBI's latest figures. That's far more costly than a high-profile ransomware attack, in fact. Now, BEC, which relies on compromised accounts or email addresses that are similar to legitimate ones, are difficult to filter as they blend with normal expected traffic. Now, the question is, how do you protect your users? Well, you get them some phishing-aware training and maybe even send them through mock scenarios to see how they will actually react. And if you haven't already, also enable MFA for your accounts as well. Now, you can also enable a new feature that Microsoft has been touting called Safe Links Defender. It's a Office 365 phishing protection feature that detonates phishing email at the point of a user clicks on a link that matches its list of known phishing pages. Now, if nothing else, this continues to hit home our point that your users are your weakest links, and by paying more attention to their habits, just might save you some money.
Our friends at Zoom are going to have to pay an $85 million fine for lying about encryption and sending data about their users to Facebook and Google. Well, Zoom has agreed to pay the $85 million to settle claims that it lied about offering end-to-end encryption and gave user data to Facebook and Google without the consent of the users. A settlement between Zoom and the filers of a class action lawsuit also covers security problems that led to rampant Zoom bombings. While the proposed settlement would generally give Zoom users $15 or $25 each and was filed this last Saturday at U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California, it came 9 months after Zoom agreed to security improvements and a prohibition on privacy and security misrepresentations in a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission. However, the FTC settlement didn't include compensation for users. Well, as the article from Ars Technica wrote in November, the FTC said that Zoom claimed it offered end-to-end encryption in June 2016 and June 2017 HIPAA compliance guides. In a January 2019 white paper, in a April 2017 blog post, and in direct responses to inquiries from customers and potential customers. In reality, quote, Zoom did not provide end-to-end encryption for any Zoom meeting that was conducted outside of Zoom's, quote, connector product, which are actually hosted on a customer's own servers, because Zoom's servers, including some located in China, maintain the cryptographic keys that would allow Zoom to access the content of its customers' Zoom meetings, according to the FTC. In real end-to-end encryption, only the users themselves have access to the keys needed to decrypt the content. Well, this kind of reminds me of when we were doing reviews for InfoWorld, where if you published a specification in your brag sheets, we would test and verify it. So maybe that's what we need to do to folks like Zoom. Test and verify. So Zoom now has to go over all its bragging to make sure they reflect reality.
Now, we all know software and data it produces is the engine that's driving IT these days. However, hardware either in traditional data centers or in the cloud no longer is front and center in the mind of IT professionals. Instead, those servers and storage appliances are the tools that enable them to run their applications quickly and efficiently and to move and store the massive amounts of data they are accumulating. Now, this shift over the past several years has rippled through the hardware world. In fact, companies like Dell Technologies, Hewlett Packard Enterprise, Lenovo, Cisco Systems still make high performance and increasingly secure systems, but their focus now is on transitioning some of the becoming solutions and services providers with plans to deliver much of it, all of their portfolios as a service. Now, it's not enough to simply collect and store the data and ensure that these enterprises can access the data. That's where pure storage comes in to the market, where it's all flash arrays came into market. Now, but in September 2020, it acquired Portworx for $370 million, a startup with a background in containing storage and Kubernetes. Now, key tools in the rapidly changing world is Kubernetes, right? The acquisition was an indication that Pure understood that managing the data and not simply storing it was becoming a required capability. Now, Pure understood data management was the way forward and that Kubernetes is driving that technology. We talk about Kubernetes a lot on this show. Now, the role of Kubernetes is expanding beyond simply orchestrating containers. It's becoming a key middleware component for managing data and its tool for managing hardware and could find itself being used to manage uncontainerized applications. Now, it'll still be used to place containers where there are available compute cycles. That is why Portworx is so interesting, because it's creating a seamless plane of data, ensuring that the data is available in every node, independent of where the data actually originated. Now, this is data management with a fast, flexible fabric at the top of the application. This is compelling to me because we all know data consistency and reliability is really a challenging thing when it comes to application clusters. Now, containers can run anywhere, on-premise or in the cloud, and the data is also needs to be seamless for your users. Now, data management needs to be multi-cloud, and solutions like those from Portworx and others operate on the premise of being able to work with any application, any Kubernetes distribution, and any underlying hardware. Sound compelling, right? Now, as the use of Kubernetes grows, so will the need to ensure organizations manage their data and correctly for their applications. Now, pay attention to these types of tools because they just might save you some time and money. Well, folks, that does it for the Blips. Next up, we have the Bytes. But before we get to the Bytes, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Worldwide Technology. Now, WWT is at the forefront of the innovation, working with the clients all over the world to transform their businesses. Now, at the heart of WWT lies their Advanced Technology Center, or ATC. It's pretty amazing. Now, the ATC is a research and testing lab that brings together technologies from leading OEMs, and there's more than $500 million in equipment invested in that lab. Now, the ATC offers hundreds of on-demand and schedulable labs representing the newest advances in multi-cloud, architecture, security, networking, primary and secondary storage, data analytics and AI, DevOps, and much, much more. Now, WWT's engineers and partners use the ATC to quickly spin up proof of concept and pilots so customers can confidently select the best solutions. Now, this helps cut evaluation time from months to weeks. Now, with the ATC, you can test out products and solutions before you go to market. Now, access technical articles, expert insights, demonstration videos, white papers, hands-on labs, and other tools that help you stay up to date with the latest technology. Now, not only does the ATC, is it a physical lab space, but WWT has also virtualized it. Now, members of the ATC platform can access these amazing resources anywhere in the world, 365 days a year. Now, while exploring the ATC platform, make sure you check out the WWT's events and communities for more opportunities to learn about technology trends and hear the latest research and insights from their experts. Whatever your business needs, WWT can deliver scalable, tried and tested, tailored solutions. WWT brings strategy and execution together to make a new world happen. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and gain access to all their free resources, visit WWT.com/twit and create a free account on their ATC platform. That's WWT.com/twit. And we thank Worldwide Technology for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the Bytes. Now, have you ever wondered how well some of those federal security or federal agencies could do if they were audited for cybersecurity? Well, I definitely would. Well, would you be surprised to find out that cybersecurity at 8 federal agencies is so poor that 4 of them earned grades of D, 3 got C's, and only 1 received a B in a report issued by the U.S. Senate Committee? Now, the report issued by the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs comes 2 years after a separate report found systemic failures by the same 8 federal agencies in complying with federal cybersecurity standards. Now, the report titled Federal Cybersecurity, America's Data Still at Risk, analyzed security practices by the same agencies for 2020. Now, it found that only 1 agency had earned a grade of B for its cybersecurity practices last year. I bet you can't guess who actually landed that grade of B. Well, let's go through some of them here. Department of State got a D. Department of Transportation, D. Education, D. Social Security Administration, D. Agricultural, D. Health and Human Services, also, well, actually, they got a C. House and Urban Development, C. And guess what? Department of Homeland Security, You got a B. Now, the State Department systems the auditors found frequently operated without the required authorizations, ran software that was no longer supported, and failed to install security patches in a timely manner. Sound familiar? Now, the Social Security Administration, meanwhile, suffered many of these same shortcomings, including a lack of authorization for many systems, use of unsupported systems, failure to comply an accurate and comprehensive IT asset inventory, and failure to provide for the adequate protection of personal identifiable information. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this to you first because you've worked with a lot of federal agencies out there. And is it surprising that a lot of them are slow to bring up their security standards?
No, I'm sad to say that the vast majority of federal agencies that I've worked for, one, they're always understaffed. I've never seen an agency that actually had enough IT people. Two, they're underpaid. So that's a problem. When you start cutting on salaries and they don't even come close to industry, you're not going to get people that are going to be self-starters. Let's call it a spade a spade. you know, I worked with the federal government for quite a few years, and because of that shortage, I got hired out to dozens and dozens of agencies. I used to generate, I think it was 500,000 to 750,000 air miles a year being flown all over the place just to put out fires. The reality is the federal government, too many agencies depended on security by obscurity. Now, keep in mind, the architecture of the internet, to get to a .gov, you actually have to go all the way up to the top level of the internet, cross over from the .com or .edu or .org, you know, that area, and then cross over to the .gov through one of the gateways, gateway routers. Now, that's all fine and good. There's some protection in there, but it's not perfect. I don't know of any IDS or IPS that's perfect, and the sad part is, you know, a lot of employees seem to think, oh, we've got these big giant firewalls up, we should be fine. No, I'm sorry. I helped put a lot of those in, and it's low bid. Come on. You know, it's just like that line in The Right Stuff where they start talking about, now realize you're sitting on top of a rocket, you know, a couple million tons of explosive built by the low bidder. And that's been the problem. It's always been the low bid, even though federal purchasing does allow for awarding a bid to someone that's not the low bidder, if and only if you're willing to do the effort to justify why the not lowest bid, you know, maybe the second highest or second lowest, doesn't matter, the other bid that wasn't low was a superior solution. But that means whoever's evaluating it actually has to be a subject matter expert, and that almost never happens.
Now, the thing I find really interesting, though, is there was obviously a report that went out last year, a very similar report. In fact, they were all graded almost the same here. And similar things had come up in the report, like, for instance, making sure that people have access to data that only they should see, or appropriate authentication mechanisms like MFA, things like this should have been implemented already. The question is, what do we need to do here, Chibert, to force these organizations to move forward? What needs to happen, you think?
So just like the private sector, cybersecurity needs to be part of the culture. You know, the federal government, most federal agencies are pretty good at, okay, you got to protect the files, you got to protect your information, but the email is just too easy to attach a file to. The culture within the agency needs to change. And sadly, I'll admit it, the agency that I worked for, we had some folks, we had this one guy that worked for us. His name is X. And the standing joke within our organization was, X is never afraid of hard work. He can sit right next to it all day long, and it doesn't scare him one bit. Now, brum bum. That's not always the case. There are some very, very good people that work for the federal government. But sadly, sometimes what you have in a lot of agencies is you have someone coming out of the military that needs a little few more years to get a full retirement, or they can't get a job in the private sector. So while it is not the norm, there are quite a few people that go into the federal government because they can't get a job in the private sector, and they're just kind of depending on passing the buck. That's the culture that we need to deal with. Once we start getting the culture changed, you start getting to the point of fixing things. So, for instance, I worked a lot with the USDA, the Food and Drug Administration, those folks. Those folks actually made a really, really big effort to change the culture. And as a result, what they did is they started doing a lot of their own class. They developed courseware for things like what is and isn't legal for contracting. How do you deal with large accounts? How do you deal with cybersecurity and different things? They've created a lot of classes to try and educate the culture within their organization. Not everybody does. So anyway, the reality is, yeah, there's a lot of things. And like Wizardling in the Discord channel is saying, unsupported systems. There is sadly an awful lot. There was a mandate that got put into place, oh, geez, I think back in the Carter administration, where they were forbidding us from buying what are called stovepipe applications, meaning custom-built systems. They wanted us to use COTS and GOTS, commercial off-the-shelf and government off-the-shelf. Sadly, like Wizardling does, kind of, start talking about, yeah, there's an awful lot of things out there that nobody has the source code to. So does this sound familiar? You know, gee, I know of a couple of banks that still have mainframes running COBOL because they don't have anything to replace it yet. So same thing, you know, people think the federal government's different. No, it's not. It's just like the commercial sector, except sadly, we don't always have the talent and we don't always have the ability to fill those empty slots.
Yeah, I mean, just like Wizarding in the Discord channel was actually asking, obviously, about these systems. Were they the mainframes? Were they the Windows machines? Were they Linux machines? This report reports all of them. You know, a lot of these machines were versions of the software, whether it was Windows or Mac OS or Linux, that were unsupported versions anymore. So they were no longer supported. They didn't have the appropriate patches on them. And in fact, the interesting thing about this, if you go look at the comments, Ant actually pointed this out in the back channel here. He said, hey, go look at some of the comments on this article. A lot of them are echoing the same thing. They were saying, hey, unless we were forced to upgrade our systems or we just kind of kept them the same. We didn't do anything to them. We didn't patch them or do anything. In fact, some of the publicly facing servers were actually hijacked at one point and were sending out viruses. Obviously you take with these a grain of salt, but it definitely echoes the theme that came along with the report, which is, hey, these systems are old and they're not being updated at the speed they should be updating. Now, Chiba, one more question back to you is, you know, one of these reports said, hey, a lot of customers or a lot of users are still using simple passwords. Even organizations out there that are in the public sector and the commercial sectors are forcing things like MFA or multi-factor authentication or forcing more complex passwords. That's a very simple thing to do. Why do you think that this is not happening in the government sectors?
Well, let's take a step back on that statement. You know, Everyone that I've talked to has all agreed that 2FA or MFA or something like that is needed. Heck, a friend of mine, Oliver Rist, the title of one of the articles he just worked on is Passwords Are Dumb or something to that matter. You know, we really shouldn't be using plain passwords anymore. You know, just about everything. At the very least, we should be using 2FA, like, you know, having a text message sent and, you know, something like that. That's not hard anymore. I mean, the PAM modules and so forth for doing a substitution, you know, saying you have to have this, you have to have MFA first and so forth. And if and only if you're at this address range, can you use a password? Not hard anymore. I mean, it's in all the Microsoft operating systems that I've ever seen. It's certainly in Linux. It's in Linux going way back. So forth. Now, the reality is it needs to change. There's a lot of tools out there. And the last time the federal government actually was given enough budget to make wide sweeping changes was actually Y2K. So if you put that in perspective, it's 21 years later, and there hasn't been a large outlay of investment in improving things. And that's one of the things that has become ungodly political. But, you know, it's going to take someone to go, you know, someone's going to have to finally notice that things are going really badly and you're going to need to go and get caught up. And we shall see. Hey, you know, we're going to talk about this forever and ever. The reality is we're going to start, I'm going to try and start getting a little bit of tidbits here and there on maybe handing some of the solutions to our federal brethren on a silver platter. So let me go try and schedule some of that, because I think some of it is lack of training. Maybe our federal brethren need some tutoring. What do you think? Maybe?
I think they do. You know, the interesting thing, and actually had another good point, is you said, hey, in most places, a D is a passing grade. The key here is when you give a scorecard like that, you know, somebody has to pay attention. You have to be held accountable for these grades, right? And the only way to be held accountable is if there's repercussions if you don't improve them, especially over a period of time. You know, so it doesn't really matter that Homeland got a B. They should strive for the A, and they should be held for a specific timeline and specific standards over time. The question is, who is going to hold all of them? And how are they going to be penalized in a way where they're forced to make changes and spend some of that dollars and the money that we give them to go and make things better? We'll have to see. We'll have to see how things go over a period of time.
Yeah. Hey, you know, it might be just like what we did for the GSA motor pool. If you didn't get the vehicle in for an oil change and a wash and wax in a reasonable amount of time, according to the agreement, your cost for that vehicle went up. Maybe that's what we need to do. Maybe if people aren't willing to upgrade, maybe their cost of the .gov internet feed needs to go up. That sounds like a heck of an idea. But you know what? We got one more bite that kind of sticks in my craw. And I'm going to lead this one just because I've got some of the background. The sad part is there a set of judges have rejected Viasat, which happens to be a fairly good size VSAT company, just like Hughes is. And they were actually trying to do a lawsuit in federal court to prohibit SpaceX from basically killing the market for them. So let's read a little bit. Viasat sued the Federal Communications Commission last May and asked judges for a stay that would have SpaceX ongoing launches to low Earth orbit for the Starlink internet service. Well, anyway, they wanted a stay so that they can show that it's likely to – they wanted to win the lawsuit alleging that FCC improperly approved satellite launches. The three-judge panel at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit Court was not persuaded, saying in a short order that, quote, Viasat has not satisfied the stringent requirements for a stay pending court review. The judges did grant a motion to expedite the appeal. However, the case should move faster than normal. Well, here's the issue. Viasat is also saying in some other media that there's an awful lot of Starlink satellites going up, and they're taking up a whole bunch of what's called arc-second spaces. So it's basically the arc-second from orbit to low Earth orbit. And so you start getting 1,500 or so satellites up there, 10,000 satellites, 15, you know, however many SpaceX plans on doing. Viasat is basically saying the FTC and so forth is allowing SpaceX to saturate low Earth orbit and make it so that nobody else can play. Now, we as a nation tend to want to try and say things should be an even playing field. But historically, America has been slow to move. So, like, for instance, Ma Bell is probably the best example I've ever seen, where AT&T, Ma Bell, got so large it became a virtual monopoly, and in protecting itself, created that monopoly so that no one else could play. And Viasat is saying, hey, SpaceX is doing the same thing. So now, on the other hand, the coverage of those SpaceX satellites means that places that could not get internet now can. In fact, some of the people off in rural America for the first time are getting reasonable internet speeds using a Starlink satellite. Now, what I'm going to throw back to Lou and ask him to comment on is, what do you think? Starlink is basically starting on their way to creating a monopoly in low Earth orbit. What do you think? Good, bad? Should we be thinking more about the good of the many versus the good of the Viasat?
You know, I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. Like, I don't consider it to be a monopoly. I consider it to be a competitive edge. And they're forcing these other companies who haven't moved their butts for a long time. Like, for instance, I noticed Dish Network is also part of these appeals. You know, they can shove it. Like, that's one of the worst companies out there. And I think they need to move forward somehow. And I think that's where SpaceX and their Starlink systems is going to force it. And I'm hoping that, that is where these companies will move forward because of it. I think that a little bit, it sounds a little bit to me like complaining, like they can't keep up with the amount of effort and the work that SpaceX is doing to make sure that the government's on their side and making sure that they can put as many satellites up there. If it does what it says it's going to do, it's going to help a lot of people move forward with getting internet that they didn't have internet before, especially at the speeds that they need to get it at. So I guess. I'm less worried about the space junk and I'm more worried that we're gonna have these legacy systems that don't move forward because they don't have the competition to push them. So I'm kind of taking that point of view. Is I'm hoping that that's what Starlink will start to do, is force them to innovate, force them to move forward, and hopefully maybe even pull some of those things down and put some stuff up there that can really help our organizations and other people.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I used Inmarsat, and I used Iridium for many, many years. In fact, I still use Iridium. And one, it's expensive. Two, the data rates on those are horribly slow, nowhere near what Starlink's doing. And Starlink is kind of going to be interesting. There's an awful lot of places, say like the deep Amazon jungle, above the Arctic Circle, way out in the middle of the Pacific or the Atlantic, where scientists really and truly want to be able to go and do some good science, help the world, but they can't get connectivity, so it doesn't happen. Something like Starlink might just do that. But when is someone else – I ask, when is someone else going to step up? And you're right, Dish and those and Viasat and those folks, they had the ability to go and launch. You know, there was lots of launch capability. you know, Starlink didn't do anything new. Right. You know, all it is just this really cool package that could, you know, do 1,500 microsats at a time. So, yeah, I do agree in one way that, yeah, those other guys were sitting on the catbird seat charging really, really high rates. I mean, Viasat, Hughes, Dish, those are really high rates for not very much bandwidth. And I question where the innovation went. So on one hand, I'm not wild about monopolies, but on the other hand, gee, Starlink did the innovation. They went as far as actually pushing, you know, their owner pushed to get a launch system going so they could get it up into orbit cheaper. So good for them on that. I'm just saying, you know, FTC and FCC, be kind of careful. This, you're walking through a minefield, and I'm really going to be interested to see how it ends up.
Indeed, indeed. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up is my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Bitwarden. Now, Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go. And it's trusted by millions. Now, empower your employees to follow password management best practices. With Bitwarden, you can securely store credentials across personal and business worlds. Every Bitwarden account begins with the creation of a personal vault. Now, my experience with Bitwarden is just how easy it is to get it integrated with any organization's workflow. Onboard quickly. Start your securing your data right now. Now, businesses need to empower employees to follow password management best practices. Use Bitwarden for your business. Now, when an individual joins a team or a company, they can be assigned to the organizational vault for access to shared credentials. They get quicker access, means quicker productivity. Now, it's fully customizable, just features using enterprise policies to adapt to your business needs. Plus, you can use Bitwarden Send, a fully encrypted method to transmit sensitive information, whether text or files, directly to anyone. Now, team members can generate unique and secure passwords for every site, and ensure passwords are not used more than once. Now, you'll minimize the risk of using weak and vulnerable passwords out there. You'll get enterprise-grade security, and there's GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA, and SOC 2 compliant. Now, their end-to-end encrypted vault helps mitigate phishing attacks by storing passwords and much, much more. Now, you can even do more with Bitwarden Enterprise plans. Some of their new features include admin password reset. Enterprise organizations can enroll in admin password reset to allow designated administrators to reset forgotten user passwords. Now, master password reprompt is a great option too. It allows you to require verification of your master password to view sensitive vault items as designated by the user. Now, interested in a business plan? Well, Bitwarden has plans that will work for you. Now, their team organization option is $3 a month per user, where you can share private data securely with your coworkers, department, or entire organization. Now, for enterprises, use Bitwarden's enterprise organization plan for just $5 a month per user. Now, their free organization plan includes two users who can store and share passwords securely. Now, Bitwarden believes that everyone should have access to basic password security tools. Now, individuals can use their basic free account forever for an unlimited number of passwords, or upgrade anytime to their premium account for less than $1 a month. And if you're looking for secure password storage for your entire family, well, their family organization option gives up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. Using the Bitwarden Cloud, you can get started in no time. Now, monitor and manage security vulnerabilities using the Bitwarden Vault Health Reports. Identify exposed, reused, weak, or potentially compromised passwords, as well as any items in your vault with inactive 2FA. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan at bitwarden.com/twit, or try for free across devices as an individual user. That's bitwarden.com/twit. And we thank Bitwarden for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Joe Byrne. He's the regional CTO of Cisco AppDynamics. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hey, nice to be here. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're excited about the topic today. But before we get to all that, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a short journey through tech and what brought you to Cisco App Dynamics?
Sure. Yeah. I started out many, many years ago with a data compiler where I was working to help validate algorithms and things like this. They would collect public data and do things like determine home values and equity and things like this and sell it to direct marketers. And I noticed that we were redoing a lot of orders. I asked to start validating the orders as they would go out. Is it the right data? Is it formatted correctly? And all these different things. And that got me started thinking about quality assurance and started delving into that and managed to do QA in a variety of retail and fintech companies, even did a stint with EA doing QA for video games. And I became frustrated with the idea of trying to test quality into software. And so wanted to move up the ladder a little bit in the SDLC, had the opportunity while I was at Johnson & Johnson to start managing engineering teams, leading those groups and building quality in and really working through that customer lens. And then over time, I started running some larger organizations and I had an incident happen. I was at a fintech and had about a 3-day outage that was pretty significant and really, it took a long time to figure out what was happening. And it's because we were doing all the monitoring of the back end and all the things that you do, CPU, memory, disk, the databases, all of this, didn't really have a good understanding of what was happening inside the application itself, right? And so went out and found AppDynamics and became a big fan, started using that. It changed the way we built software. And then I went on to Albertsons, the grocery chain, and I brought that in to help me monitor and manage my on-premise customer-facing applications and also help me in my migration to the public cloud. And so being a two-time customer after the acquisition where Cisco purchased AppDynamics, they wanted somebody to come in and kind of be the external voice of the CTO office. And so I work with kind of C-1 or 2 customers and prospects on strategies around things like AI ops, full stack observability. I do things like this. I bring information back and work with product and engineering on what the customer's needs are, where I see trends going, things like that. So that's kind of how I got here, and I'm absolutely having a ball. It's been 3.5 years now, and it's been a great time.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, application performance management, it's a challenge. I know because I do it every day. I have to manage services and applications, making sure that they're running performantly and that customers, that their experience that they're seeing, their perceived performance is great. And then they feel like things are going really smoothly. Now, I want to get your point of view of like what the landscape looks like here, because a lot of services out there, applications, they have a lot of different clusters of services behind the scenes in the cloud that they interact with. And there's different channels and protocols they have to interact with. Plus, sometimes you have clients that, applications, whether it's on a mobile or web application, that might actually interact with several different backends to pull data in and do more things at the kind of like the PWA type apps at the client level. What are you seeing more of, and how has that kind of changed over time when it comes to architecture and how applications are dealing with it?
Yeah, it's just what you said. I mean, things are becoming more and more complex. I mean, in our ever never-ending strive and efforts to make sure that we provide an optimal experience that for an easy-to-use application and provide the customer with the optimal experience that they want, we end up making things more difficult on us, right, the technologists and everything that we're doing on the back end. And now as we do things like cloud and we've got these hybrid technologies, often cases, and so many different new things like Kubernetes and just there's new technologies coming out left and right, all with some great advantages that everybody wants to take advantage of. But it's just more complex, right? And things like microservices that now where you're having to monitor and watch all these different services instead of just this monolithic application. And you have to make sure each one of these things is performant because it can impact multiple applications in some cases, right? So it's just gotten more and more complex. But also, I mean, at the same time, the use of applications and digital services has become so prevalent that there are high expectations around how these things perform. And from the customer perspective, if yours doesn't, somebody else's probably will, and there's they'll move on. So it's become more complex, more difficult for us on the back end to make sure we understand what's going on through the full stack observability. But it's absolutely necessary to succeed today.
Right. Now, we talked about this a little bit earlier in the show, how Kubernetes, you know, obviously worries more about managing services and deployment of those services. But we also talked a little about how data, how now it has to care more about data, not just services, obviously, because data sometimes has, you know, has to be interactive with those services. Services are supposed to be state free. They're supposed to be stateless and they're supposed to interact with backends or data storages so that they can, you know, pull data at, you know, just in time. Now that could be slow. There could be issues with those types of things. There could be something wrong with the database. There could be something wrong with the cluster, the protocol, or the communication channels. What are application companies doing? What are organizations doing to manage that today?
Yeah, this is where and why the full stack observability has become such a big focus lately. It's such a hot topic. It is absolutely essential to understand not everything that's going on just inside your cloud instance or inside your data center, wherever you may be. But now you have to see and understand what's going on between my phone and my application, right? Joe's application on my phone, on my local network in my house, as it goes out to my local ISP and goes out through the internet and goes into the network of the software company and behind the firewall and the application servers and wherever it goes beyond there, right? You have to understand that entire journey, because at the end of the day, you're right. There can be an error or a problem in any one of those. And the thing is, you know, today, the user doesn't care whose fault it is. If they're using your application, it's your fault. They don't necessarily think about all the things going on behind, and nor should they. And it's the application experience that they're having using that application on your product, and that's the part they care about. But yeah, I mean, it, like I said, the complexity nowadays, because of how, you know, simple things are becoming to use and available they are to us, it's just crazy all the different places where you can have a problem. But you have to have insights into all of them.
Right. Right. Now, we talked a lot about on this show how the pandemic has, you know, forced organizations to think about the new norm, hybrid workforce, you know, remote workforce. And we've talked a lot of different facets of that and what that means. What are you seeing from your perspective, organizations having to deal with more of when it comes to kind of this new norm?
Yeah, it's really been interesting. There were companies who had a hard time gaining adoption on some of their applications prior to the pandemic, who then almost overnight were having a hard time handling the scale, right, of the application because it was getting so much demand and so much use. You know, people went from having this brick and mortar retail experience to everything being online. And just like a Nordstrom's or somebody who's famous for having this experience in the store, well, now you need to provide that same level of experience to people virtually, right, on their device. And so, yeah, we did this survey about 13,000 different consumers and found that the amount of focus that they have on these applications, these digital services now, has really, really increased. And they're using these applications for everything. It's not just work. It's a lifeline back to what is some semblance of normalcy for people. They're using it for all their health, their doctor's appointments. They're using it to shop for everything. They're using it for worship. They're using it for, I mean, the number of different applications that this applies to now is crazy. And so the use has gone way up. Expectations have gone way up. So behaviors have definitely changed.
Now, you bring up an interesting point, because a lot of times, you know, I know family and friends have used, you know, communication services, social networking services, you know, and sharing services, file storage, that kind of thing, more and more now, as you know, as they move forward, especially during the pandemic. The interesting thing here is there's some interesting things in here that we don't think about. Like, for instance, you know, I saw something in the report, something about food delivery services actually increasing some reliance on them during the pandemic. Makes sense. More people want their stuff delivered. Now, how are these companies in these different sectors? How are they holding in the pandemic? Do they need to make some changes here, especially around reliability and performance? Does the report kind of bring some of that out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've really had to change their perspective. I mean, it was such that before the pandemic, there were kind of two types of people, really, honestly, that I had seen that understood the importance of the application, you know, an APM. It was those who had been burned and had a horrible experience they never wanted to live through again, like me, or the very few who were forward-thinking enough to understand where things were going and how important it is to provide that that optimal experience for the customers, right? And really have that customer lens on whenever they're building software and doing things. Well, now everybody understands, and they have to, because they've seen their customers move over to these environments. They've seen the demand go up. They've been unable to scale and handle the load and the traffic that is coming to these applications in many cases. And so now they've had to build up and ensure that not only can they scale, but that they can do it properly. They can do it while still maintaining the same level of performance with the users. And at the same time, doing this while users' expectations are actually rising, right? I mean, when we went through and we look at this, and I mentioned, you know, people think it's the brand, it's 72% of these respondents blame the brand for any problem at all with that application. And so, you know, they've had to adjust to that new expectation. So groups like SRE, I've seen much more SRE on the rise, these system reliability engineers who kind of understand the application and the infrastructure and network and all that goes into this, who now are reliable for these, you know, we hear about 5.9s and these other numbers. And performance is becoming more and more a part of everybody's job. I mean, when I was hiring up engineers in my last role, they weren't just responsible for the functionality of the application and the quality of the application. They were responsible for the performance of the application and the security of the application as well. And with DevOps and DevSecOps now, where these teams are building and owning these things, they've had to adjust to this. And it's been quite a challenge for a lot of them. They've been kind of behind in that world and really had to learn and understand how to monitor that entire journey and that entire ecosystem for their applications, where before they really weren't doing that. So it's been quite a learning curve, and they've had to adjust fast.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that a lot of these applications and services developers and organizations have to go and wear many hats, because you're right. Like, a lot of them are trying to have to consider performance with their services. You know, obviously how secure things are. They have to develop their own KPIs and metrics to be able to measure these things correctly. And sometimes they get them wrong. So they do need a lot of help. So I do want to get back into a lot more of that when we come back. But before we do, I do have to thank another great sponsor of this week, Enterprise Tech, and that is IT Pro TV. Advance or launch your IT career in a fun and creative way. IT Pro TV is the best online source for IT education. Now, their edutainers make learning IT interesting and really fun. Now, IT Pro TV provides the most up-to-date information while preparing you for the exams that give you the certs employers are truly looking for in their future IT employees. Now, IT Pro TV has many things. Listen to this. 7 studios and over 1,500 hours of IT training, which creates the perfect environment for you to learn IT. And they're always adding new content. Now, courses are divided into 20 to 30 minute episodes. They are the official video training partner for CompTIA. And in fact, IT Pro TV's courses are live and on demand worldwide via Chromecast, Roku, Apple TV, PC, or their iOS or Android apps. Now, learn anytime from the comfort of your own home and on your own schedule. Now, IT Pro TV is having a free weekend, August 14th and 15th, and the following courses will be free. Yes, that's right. They are free. It's a great opportunity for anyone new to IT. Now, the courses are CompTIA IT Fundamentals Plus, Linux Essentials, Microsoft 365 Fundamentals, the MS-900, the Apple Certified Support Professional, Mac OS Support, Essentials 10-13, Hands-on PC Build, and Cisco CCT Routing and Switching 100-490. Also, be sure to check out IT Pro TV's webinar about the new CompTIA apprenticeship program that's available on demand at itpro.tv/webinars. Whether you're an organization or an individual interested in starting and expanding your IT skills, it's time to check out IT Pro TV. Get certified in Apple security skills, Python, Cisco, and so many more things. Go to itpro.tv/enterprise. You use code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/enterprise. Use code ENTERPRISE30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Joe Byrne. He's regional CTO of Cisco AppDynamics. Now, Joe, you brought up a really good point. A lot of these organizations out there, they're having to wear many different hats. Now, I'm going to get a little bit into what AppDynamics does here, because it's going to help, and especially not only in performance, but also the security realm as well. Can you maybe take us through a little bit of what organizations, as they move into AppDynamics, what they get and how this really can help their workflows?
Yeah. So AppDynamics at its core is APM, right? Application Performance Monitoring. So we are actually inside of the application, attached to the runtime. It's not kind of that from the network view of the application. It's inside out. And really understands tracks and traces every single transaction that goes on. There's some machine learning and AI algorithms in there that it helps understand what normal is. It alerts you if all of a sudden performance is outside of what normal might be, in case there's some kind of performance degradation, things like that. And helps you not only understand what's happening, what that impact is to the consumer and the end user, but where it is, right? Is it the network or is it the application? And helps you, get to root cause and increase your MTTR. And, we also, we talk about increasing MTTI, which for so many of the network teams or SRE teams who get the blame, right, when there's a problem with the applications, they spend like 30% of their time just proving these problems aren't their own. And we can help with that, right? We can decrease that mean time to innocence and help get the issues put in the right place and put on the right people's desks. And then, at a broader scope, with Cisco, part of the reason I joined was because I knew and could see the value and the potential of Cisco having something that sits inside layer 7 and understands the applications the way AppDynamics does, combined with some of the other opportunities. So now we've got things like ThousandEyes and AppDynamics working together for that full stack observability. You can understand the network and the application, and you can look at that and decide, okay, well, yes, it's clearly an application issue or a network issue. And then also having things like you mentioned, security. We have Secure Application now, which allows us to monitor in production in real time and look for security vulnerabilities. And we've got the ability in there with some, we can watch and see, and not only are these vulnerabilities there, but are they being taken advantage of in some situations, right? So we've got a policy-based system where if you're, say, you've got an application on the phone and it's not supposed to reach out to the contacts, we would not always see it, but we can see it and stop it. So it's a little bit like a RASP system, only this is running all the time, right, in production. And that's, again, with the support of the Cisco security world. So it starts out, and there's a maturation process from just understanding how my application works, all the dependencies, what the performance looks like, then adding in the other pieces into our correlation engine to be able to take the network information, the end user monitoring, the infrastructure data from your cloud or your data center, put it all together, and really build a good understanding and correlation around what things look like for your user. And then as you advance forward, one of the things you mentioned was looking at KPIs. And yeah, there are KPIs around performance and some of those technology related things. And we used to call them NFRs, right? These non-functional requirements to talk about, how long a page should load or how long a certain action should take. But those KPIs, the other thing is the ability to tie your application to the business purpose, right? Most applications are built to support whatever business you're in, whether it's delivering a product or a service, whatever those things might be. Most often these applications are either built to support that process or to deliver it. And so understanding how the application is meeting those business needs through what we call our business analytics is BIQ. And so because we do track and trace, we see all these applications, see all this transactions inside your application, we can actually see the data, aggregate it and elevate it up and show you. So you can say like today, average conversion was X or average, revenue on these days is Y. And if that drops or changes, you can dig into there and go into the application and see why. So being able to tie your application and its performance to your business performance, huge, especially today where so much of the business is now the application, right? And like I said, out of the brick and mortar and into the virtual world and onto my iPad or my phone, whatever it may be. That experience and understanding, am I supporting the business correctly? If I make these changes to my technology, how will that impact my business? And making those educated, smart decisions and prioritizing based upon performance and impact to the business with the application is huge. So those are some of the things and the advantages that the AppDynamics and Cisco can bring.
Yeah, it's interesting you point that out because I think perceived performance can definitely impact your users. It could deter them from wanting to use the system. Again, ultimately having an impact on your business. Well, I do want to bring Cheebert back in. Cheebert, you have some questions?
Yeah, this is actually one of my standard questions that I ask whether it's network monitoring, app monitoring, whatever. How do you deal with information overload? That's one of my biggest problems. You know, I've had all kinds of instruments, but now I've got all kinds of pieces of glass that I have to have up just to monitor what's going on. You know,
yep.
Is maybe AI? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, no, exactly. So we have we've built a correlation engine inside of AppDynamics that does pull in all of this data and look at all of this and build out these models and understand what information, like how the data from the infrastructure is working and what does that look like in terms of its interaction with the application that it's hosting and then with the network. So we do. We use the AI and the machine learning to go through and review all of this data. You know, one example is anomaly detection. So we will save snapshots when we detect an anomaly that happens, right? Well, we let the application itself review and go through whatever hundreds, thousands of these anomalies to come back with commonality and eventually root cause, right? Causality. And so that's where we really need to see what's happening. And the other part of it is, you know, as you're collecting data and you're monitoring things in real time, you don't need everything, right? And as we don't sample, but we monitor and watch everything that goes on. And we hang on to that data that where there is an anomaly or where you may need to go back and do some review and look at things. When things are just humming, you don't need all that data. But yeah, it's hard to determine what that is. And oftentimes, in terms of what you want to understand for the total health of your application, on average web page, like as an example, like I buy a lot of shoes online, right? I'm kind of into the sneakerhead thing. And so there's probably only a couple of things on those pages that I really need to do for that business. I need to be able to find the item, I need to be able to add it to my cart, and I need to be able to purchase it. So when looking at the health of the application, monitoring those business transactions, which is how AppDynamics monitors performance is by business transaction, is way more important than can I zoom in on the shoe or can I twist it around to be able to see the bottom, what it looks like. There's different things, right? So understanding what's really critical to the success of the customer's experience journey, and then understanding which data matters and how to put it together, how it kind of coalesces together in the correlation engine, that's really what we're using the machine learning and AI for. Because, it's just too much for anybody to do themselves.
Yeah, well, speaking of changing, what kinds of things are you seeing in the AppDynamics crystal ball for leading us towards post-pandemic? What's happening?
Well, I will say this. So one of the things in this study we did, this App Attention Index here, that I didn't buy it, right? They came back and it looked like on average of these 13,000 people, they're using 42 different applications or digital experiences, right, to live their lives. And that includes, you know, personal and business and all sides of it. And I thought, 42, that's crazy, right? And then I stopped and I thought, okay, well, these are all the tools I use to communicate through work. These are all the tools I'm using at work. These are all the applications I'm using in my personal life, whether it's communicate with my family, to buy things, whatever it may be, doctor's appointments, right? Paying bills, all these different things. And it's about right. And what I see is a lot of that's here to stay. The amount of time, effort, and money that businesses have put into these applications and providing that optimal experience is not throwaway. And the expectations of the users are not going to go away either. You know, they've got these really high expectations. And like I said, you know, we've got like 80% of them are saying now that this is how they live their life. They use these things and rely on them to get by their every day. And their expectations are high. And those aren't all going to go away. And so I think that things have kind of, in some respects around the application, it's changed forever. Some things are going to go back to normal and be easier, but working from home, you know, we see every day somebody else has announced now they're going to allow their people work from home. So these digital experiences we have and these tools and these pieces of software are not going away, and they're going to have to continue to improve and find new ways to deliver value and differentiate, and it's here to stay.
Right. Well, folks, all good things must come to an end. That's right. Joe, thank you so much for being here. Really do appreciate it. Running a little low on time, but do want to give you maybe a chance to tell the folks at home where they can go and learn more about AppDynamics and maybe how they can get started.
Yeah, just go to appdynamics.com and there's options to review and look at all the different feature functionality, ways to reach out and contact your local sales rep who can come in. They do business value analysis to where they come in and look and see how they can help save you money, because cost is always a big deal today, how they can help in terms of mitigating all the war rooms and the headaches that go on and all of the blaming and the finger pointing that can happen when there's software problems in today's world, and how to help you out. So yeah, get online, check it out, and give it a try. It's I'll never build software again without it.
Indeed. Thanks, Joe. Well, folks, you've done it, and you sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian G. G-Bert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? And how can people get a hold of you?
Well, you know, we've been getting some amazing feedback, you know, and I enjoy it. I especially enjoy seeing the feedback from people all around the world. We don't get as much as I hope for, but, you know, my Google Translate is quite handy. Sometimes I flip back and forth between Microsoft Translate or Google Translate. You know, it depends on the language. But you know what? I love hearing from people. On Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and I'd love to hear from you on that. But you're also welcome to drop me a line, an email at Chebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T at twit.tv, or better yet, Twyatt at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your ideas. And yes, Chumley, all the amazingly negative are mine, all mine. Yeah, I love it. I love hearing from the chat room. Some of the snark has been just amazing. So you know what? Help me out with some titles, everybody.
Thanks, Jeebert. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to our enterprise show and get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. Now go to our show page right now. It's twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the co-host information, show notes, the guest information. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. So support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices or on any one of your podcast applications, which are on all of them. So definitely subscribe and support the show. No, you may have heard, there's also another way to do this too. Club Twit. That's right. It's a members only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. It's now one of my favorite things about it is also the exclusive access to the members only Discord channel. We've got a lot of great topics and questions, and we talked a lot about great things in those channels just today. It's really interesting, really fun. So definitely join the movement. Come be part of Club Twit. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with giving them the gift of Twyatt. I definitely have. And I'll tell you one thing. We talk a lot about some fun tech topics on the show, and I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely share Twyatt with them as well. Now, if you're already subscribed and you're available on these days, Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do the show live. That's right. Come see how the pizza's made, all the behind the scenes. That's live. twit.tv, great website, shows the live stream, and we are on it right now. So definitely come join the live stream. Now, if you're going to join the live stream, you might as well also join our famous IRC channel. Now, Ant showed a quick picture of the channel there. We have some great characters in there. All our hosts are in there normally. We have some great topics in there, great discussions, some great characters. So definitely join the show, be part of the show, be in our IRC channel as well as irc.twit.tv. Now, in fact, go right now, hop over to Twitter, follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all of our enterprise tidbits. I also post and have some great conversations with people like you. I want to get some show ideas from you, so definitely come over, direct message me, give me some show ideas. Just like Chebert, we want to hear from you. We want to hear what things you want us to talk about, go through, and take you through the industry. So definitely check out and go and jump over there right now and direct message me. Now, if you want to know what I do at Microsoft, go check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There you'll find all the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your Office experience to make it more productive for you. And also definitely check out OfficeScript. It's our new latest and greatest ways for Excel documents online to record macros and customize it all using just very simple JavaScript and TypeScript. So definitely check it out right now. It's awesome. And I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, because without them, we couldn't do this show, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support. Also, thank you to all the engineers and staff at Twit. Again, we couldn't do with this show without them. And also thank you one more time to Mr. Brian Cheap, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you again, Cheebert, for all your support. Now, before we sign out, I do want to thank our editor as well, Mr. Victor. He does all the magic behind the scenes and makes us look good on the recorded version of this show. So thank you, Victor, for all your support and your help. Plus also our technical director for today. He's the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. Now, Ant, you're doing some amazing stuff over there on some of these shows at Twit. What can you share with us and what you're doing this week?
Well, we had a lot of fun talking general feedback with our hands-on photography listeners, but I also want to plug, go ahead and check out wanderersphoto.com. That's a workshop that I'll be teaching at in New Orleans this October, and we're also going to do a bit of a little hangout on air next Tuesday and just chit-chat and talk over some drinks. Me, my man, Mr. Steve Brazel, Andrew Scrivani, and, of course, Freddie Clark. So check it out, wanderersphoto.com. Register, and I'll see you in New Orleans.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ant. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that podcast episode. If you would like to check out more about tech news, then you should check out Tech News Weekly with me, Micah Sargent, my co-host Jason Howell, where we interview the people making and breaking the tech news every week.